You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
I am honored to have as my guest this week the legendary broadcast journalist Diane Rehm. She was the host of the Diane Rehm Show from 1979 to 2016 on National Public Radio. She hosts a podcast called On My Mind. She's the author of several books, and her most recent is When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. Diane Rehm, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you so much for having me.
It's hard to say that I enjoyed your book. Your book was an intense experience. It was a very personal book for you, I think. And so how did you become an advocate for the right to die?
You know, I think it began when I was a very young woman, when my mother was dying at age 49. I was just 19 years old, and she was suffering from liver cancer and really suffering intensely and begging to die, literally begging to die. She finally did die, but not after going through tremendous pain. And sadly, I got to her bedside 20 minutes too late. My father died 11 months later of a broken heart. When I married my late husband of 54 years, John Rehm, his father took his own life at age 72 because of diabetic retinopathy. He was working and living on his own farm, having been a journalist for all of his life, and realized he couldn't go on. So he took his own life. And John's mother, at age 92, because of terrible back pain that couldn't be treated, took her own life. So it was all around us. And it's as though death is something I've never not thought about. So I think when the opportunity came along to participate in the documentary, the film documentary, which will be shown on PBS in April.
And does that film have the same, sorry to interrupt, Diane, does that film have the same title as the book?
Exactly. You see, the book is based on the film. The film came first. And then about 1 year into the film, I thought, I need to document this in another way. So I took what we had done in the film. I took, I think, 25 of the 45 or 50 interviews we had done around the country and turned it into a book. So the film, the documentary came first, then my book, which is based solely on the documentary, with the exception of the introduction by John Grisham.
I've heard of him.
Oh, just a wonderful writer, and I feel so honored that he was willing to write that for me.
It's a lovely piece that he wrote. Is he a friend of yours?
Well, I've interviewed him many, many times over the years, and one of the last times I spoke with him, we were waiting to begin the interview, he said, "Well, what have you been up to?" And I told him about the documentary and that I was writing the book. And then a couple of weeks later, I mean, he was clearly very interested. He said, I totally support medical aid in dying, and I'm really on your side. So a couple of weeks later, I sent him an email and asked him whether he'd be willing to write the introduction, and he fully agreed. So
it's really lovely.
Good.
So I have a few questions. Sure. So do you draw a distinction, Diane Rehm, between suicide and right to die?
Oh, sure. People who commit suicide decide that they want to die. They don't want to live anymore. People who take on medical aid in dying want nothing more than to live. As a matter of fact, one of the young women I spoke with, who was 37 at the time, she has since died, she said, you know, I'd like nothing better than to live until I'm 90 years old. She said, but I won't. I'm going to die. So the least I can do for myself is to have some control over how I die. She had a 13-year-old son. She said, I don't want him to see me suffer. I don't want him to experience watching me deteriorate.
I guess you could relate to that, huh?
I really can.
The arguments for and against right to die in various states, do they fall like so much does today on around party lines?
No. They fall on religious lines, they fall on within the medical community, which is somewhat divided between older physicians and younger ones. They fall within the disabled community, some who very much want to be allowed to have medical aid in dying, and some who fear they will be put to death. And it falls on racial lines, with good reason. The African American community has been mistrustful of the medical community, with good reason, for many years. Consider just the Tuskegee experiments, when men were infected deliberately with syphilis. And yet, an African Methodist Episcopal pastor said to me that if he could be assured that medical aid in dying would be done honestly and fairly and justly, he would be in favor of it. But he said, right now, he does not trust the medical community. And we've seen that in terms of the resistance to the COVID vaccine within the African American community. So there are reasons, but the most outspoken and the most negative group against medical aid in dying, and the one that's put the most money into it, is the Roman Catholic Church.
And so when you say they put money into it, so they're like actively campaigning against it.
Absolutely. For example, in Massachusetts where a referendum several years ago, and I testified in Massachusetts and in Maryland, and the Catholic Church was very active against it in both states. A referendum in Massachusetts indicated that there were 70% of those in Massachusetts who favored medical aid in dying, at which point the Roman Catholic Church stepped in with $5 million and put an end to it.
Wow.
So they are the most active of the opponents.
How is there a correlation, a relationship between right to die and abortion and the death penalty to other legal issues about death?
The death penalty occurs when someone has committed, presumably, a crime and has been judged guilty and is sentenced by his or her peers to death. He or she
is the
has
resist-
no choice.
Right, but is there, is the political aspect of the death penalty, the people who are opposed to the death penalty or in favor of the death penalty, how do they fall on the right to die issue? Is there any?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And what about, yeah, and I guess abortion, though, probably it's the same people who oppose abortion are the same people who oppose right to die.
Perhaps. Yeah. I would think so. I would think so.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with broadcast journalist Diane Rehm. Her new book is called When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End.
You talk to so many interesting people, and, you know, right now with the pandemic, you know, death is like all around us all the time, every day. It even seems like, not related to the pandemic, the number of famous people in the obituaries in the last couple of months, it's like every day. It's really astounding. And so I wonder, was it hard to get people to talk to you? How do people feel about talking about this?
You know, death has been the great taboo. Nobody wants to talk about death. I spoke at a church in upstate New York, and there were about 350 people in the congregation. And I started by saying, how many of you have decided you're not going to die? And of course, there was exactly that little giggle, that uncomfortable giggle. The fact of the matter is we are all going to die at some point, which we'd rather not think about, not talk about, and certainly not plan for. My hope and my ambition for both the documentary and the book is that it will get people like you, more doctors, more legislators, more just everybody to talk about what they want at the end of life, because we don't want to plan for it. For example, we finished, thank goodness, we finished the documentary and I finished the book long before COVID began. We were not filming after December of 2019, so we were finished. As soon as COVID hit, I called my own doctor, whom I had chosen, left a previous doctor, because when I asked her whether she would support me in medical aid in dying, she said no, she was not interested. So I left her and found a doctor who would support me. So the first thing I did when the COVID virus came along was to call my doctor and said, I want you to know if I come down with COVID, I do not wish to be hospitalized. I do not wish to be intubated. I will take oxygen. And she interjected, well, we can give you 140% of oxygen in your home, but in a hospital, we could give you 160% of oxygen. I said, I'm not going to a hospital, and I'm not going to be intubated. You and I both know that many people are suffering even now, after they have been cured of COVID, because they've suffered from the after effects of both intubation and the virus itself. So that's where I stand. If I have a heart attack, Gary, I'm not picking up the phone to call 911. Because those folks on the rescue squad are by law instructed to do everything they can to resuscitate me.
Regardless of your advance directives or whatever.
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. And I'm 84 years old and I've lived a great life. And I don't want to live out the results, say, of a terrible stroke or a terrible heart attack that would leave me not being able to do the things I've always loved doing, writing and broadcasting and doing everything I want to do. I don't want to do that. So I've given those instructions very clearly.
Well, of course, nowadays, Diane Rehm, 84 is young. People are living much longer.
84 is getting up there. 84 is getting up there. I'm sort of in that middle passage. Between...
You're middle-aged.
Don't I wish? I mean, middle-aged these days is in your 60s.
When I turned 65, I said, I'm now officially middle-aged.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, let me ask you about which states have it's like there's 50 states and they all have their own. It's not a federal law about it.
And never going to be a federal law. Each state, there are 9 states plus the District of Columbia, yay,
where you live,
where I live, which do have medical aid in dying. There are about 20 states currently debating whether to move in that direction, including New York, including Connecticut, including New Mexico. I mean, they're all over the country. The debate is a good one.
And is there a red state to blue state or not necessarily? It's just of these 9 states, are they all blue states or something?
Well, I mean, Colorado is kind of a mixed bag. Montana is a mixed bag, and that does have it by court decree. So you can't quite put it in that, in those two categories. It's mixed, but Maine has it. New Hampshire is going for it, I think. And Connecticut is going for it, but I know Maine does have it.
Yeah, you know, I'm a person who thinks that if people want to do the things they want to do, whatever those things are, as long as they're not hurting other people, then those people should be allowed to do what they want to do. So, you know, gay marriage or...
But God forbid, say you came down with a terrible disease, God forbid, would you want your family to find your body with a gunshot in your head at the end because you couldn't go peacefully in your bed with your family around you, comforting you, being with you, expressing their love to you? That's how I want to go. And too many people, out of frustration with the system as it is, when they can't, as my husband couldn't get help. It's awful. My husband had to starve himself to death. Mm. And it took him 10 long days.
My goodness.
And he said, he had terrible Parkinson's disease. He was in a nursing home in Maryland. And the doctor said, I cannot help you. So John said, I will begin the journey on my own. And he did.
Well, Diane Riemann, your book, I was sort of shocked to learn that even in states where there is right to die, there are restrictions on how that can happen. So that, for instance, you have to take it orally, even though it might taste horrible and be awful to take orally rather than have an intravenous injection or something. What's that all about?
An intravenous injection would necessitate the presence and the action of a physician. And in parts of Europe, I'm sure you know, they do have an injection given by doctors. It's called euthanasia. And that individual asks for it. That individual wants it and is given it. In this country, I doubt that that's ever going to be the case. Rather, the thought is that you have your own personal physician, first and foremost, who determines that you're within 6 months of death. That doctor has to get another doctor to confirm that decision. In some states, there has to be a psychiatric examination done solely with the patient, so there are no relatives, no friends, nobody else around who could be coercing that patient to take his or her own life via medical aid in dying. But I'll tell you something else. Oregon, the first state in the country to enact medical aid in dying, and the law upon which all the others have been based, is now moving somewhat on this issue of self-administration. For example, someone with ALS has virtually no muscular function. There can be allowed the use of an elbow to start a process where the medication is delivered rectally. So things are moving along, recognizing exactly the obstacles you're talking about.
My stepfather was told by his doctor to put his things in order and that probably in the next 6 months he was going to die. And he died about 2.5 years later.
Good.
It was good, but it was also bad because he was waiting. The doctor told him 6 months. And so he spent the rest of his life waiting to die, as opposed to, well, I'm going to live until I die. When a doctor says you're within 6 months of death, it's one thing if you have Lou Gehrig's disease, but it's another thing if you're, you know, doctors are not always right when you're talking about the
Absolutely.
Mistrust of the medical community.
Absolutely.
And,
but there's something different here, Gary.
Mm-hmm.
Your father, was it your father?
Stepfather, my stepfather.
Your stepfather was not asking to die. He was not asking for medical aid in dying. And if my husband had been here in Washington, D.C., and at the time the law was not even in place here in D.C., if he had said, look, and this was the reality, I can no longer stand on my own, I can no longer feed myself, I can no longer toilet myself, I am in a state where I have lost my dignity. And if I continue to live, I'll lose even more of it. So I am ready to die. Your stepfather didn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor, who knows why, gave him that prognosis.
Offered this information, yes.
Who knows why? But I agree with you. It's not a science.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with broadcast journalist Diane Rehm. Her new book is called When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End.
How does the American Medical Association stand on the issue?
They are standing pat, and they are saying that we do not support medical aid in dying. But now remember, you've got an older group of doctors involved in the AMA, and you've got a whole new younger group of physicians, including my own daughter and son-in-law, coming along saying, you know, this makes sense. Do no harm may actually mean do nothing more to try to keep this patient alive for my ego's sake, because I, the doctor, don't want to give up. I don't want to say I lost this patient. I'm going to do everything I can to keep this patient alive. And if the patient wants that, Gary, that's fine. I believe so strongly that if you want God to be the only decider, that's what you should have. If you want absolutely everything medical science can provide, That's what you should have. And if you want medical aid in dying, as I do, that's what I think you should have.
My mother-in-law died last November.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. And hospice.
Is she a good woman? Did you like her?
Wonderful. I loved her very much. She was a wonderful, wonderful person.
Lovely.
And hospice came in at the very end, and they were amazing. They were so amazing. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about hospice.
Hospice is great, as well as palliative care. But neither hospice nor palliative care is in the business of medical aid in dying. So they're not there to help you along. They are there to keep you comfortable.
On your way.
On your way.
And that's a distinction. Definitely.
That's a very significant distinction.
So you talked to, you talked to probably, how many people did you talk to when you were working
probably
on the film?
About 45, 50, even more. We talked to a priest, an African-American pastor. We talked to caregivers. We talked to lovers and wives and husbands who had been left behind. We talked to nurses. We talked to a whole range of people.
You're such a great interviewer, and you've been doing it for so long. When you're talking to someone like the priest that you interviewed, who is has a completely different point of view than yours, how do you stay removed, so to speak, from your point of view? Or do you? Do you argue or do you?
Oh, no. Oh, no. I wasn't there to argue. Right. I was there to listen. And listen is what I did. And you will see that in the film. You will not see me arguing at all. But rather, I did ask one physician. We were in California, and she was a palliative care physician in a very low-income hospital. And I said to her, because we visited with several of her patients who were very, very sick. And I said to her, at what point do you say to a patient, I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do? And she said, oh, never.
Oh.
Never. And that's where I part company, because I believe, as one of my guests said, you are put on this wheel of medical activity, from which there is no exit except to die. Whereas maybe without all the injections and the chemo and the radiation that is probably going to kill you anyhow, maybe you'd be more comfortable being at home for the last days of your life with your family.
Now, Diane,
I want to know, how would you like to die? What would you consider a good death?
Well, Diane, for me, it's not an issue because I'm not planning to die.
Okay.
Okay. That fails someone else. Well, seriously, I would like to live to be an old guy and die in my sleep.
And die in your sleep, very peacefully.
And then bounce my final mortgage check, having spent all of my money. You have a cute little doggy that you showed me a minute ago.
And,
and we all have our pets and we love them. And I think for probably most people, when you lose your pet, probably early in your life, whether your pet was a hamster or a doggy or whatever, that's your first experience with death. And I've had dogs and the dogs have become like my children. I love my dogs.
Of course.
And when they die at 13 or 14, it's as heartbreaking as any death in your life.
Absolutely.
But we are also always, we always know it's time to put our pets down and we call the vet and they come out or we take them there. It's funny that we don't have any of these compunctions about our pets who we love and cherish as humans or as beings, let's say, but we have this taboo about it with people.
And the more we talk about it, the more we confront the reality, which clearly you're not going to do.
No, I'm not going to do that.
The more we confront the reality that at some point it is going to come, the more open and honest we'll be with ourselves and with our friends, our spouses, our doctors about what it is we want. I'm sure you read in my book about these death cafes, which have sprung up all over the country. Groups of friends, groups of relatives, church groups, people who've never seen each other before, coming together to talk about death. In Indianapolis, there's a neighborhood group that meets once a month, and they come to talk about death and what they want and what they don't want. And that whole neighborhood knows, in fact, what to do for that person when that time comes. Doesn't that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. It really does. It was remarkable to read about it, and I think that your book is such an important work. When my time comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. But before we go, Diane Rehm, I've never had the opportunity to speak with you before, but I feel like I know you because you've talked to me day in and day out for 40 years. How did you become a broadcaster in the first place?
It was crazy. I stayed at home for 14 years, raising my two children, entertaining for my husband, doing volunteer work. And then as they neared that point where my son was going off to college, my daughter was going off to boarding school, it began to hit me. You know, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And a friend of mine mentioned that she was working as a volunteer at this tiny little radio station at American University, WAMU, which at the time, when you went off the curb, you couldn't hear the station anymore. Since then, it has become one of the largest stations in the entire country in the public radio network. It was not even then a member of NPR because it only had 2 full-time employees and you had to have 5. At any rate, when she said she was volunteering on this tiny little show called The Home Show, I thought, well, I wonder, could they use maybe another volunteer? And she asked, and the host of the program said, of course, have her come in. So I went in for an interview, and she said, good, come back next Monday. I show up next Monday. I am so nervous, Gary. You have no idea. I had no college education, and this was on the campus of American University. I had never even barely been on a college campus, so I was really nervous. I am greeted at the door by the manager, a young woman, and she said, you must be the new volunteer. And I said, yes. And she said, well, I have some bad news. And I thought she was going to tell me to turn around and go home. She said, the host is out. Now you're laughing. So she said, so I, the manager, am going to host the show, and I want you to come into the studio with me and be part of the program. And for 90 minutes, we interviewed somebody from the Dairy Council. I mean, if I ever had an opportunity to listen back to it, I'd probably turn beet red. But I mean, I knew about butter, I knew about meat, I knew about milk, and I knew what I fed my kids, and I wasn't shy. So, and I probably have been on the air ever since. And that was back in 1973.
But you probably remember old-time radio.
Oh, my gosh. I grew up on The Lone Ranger and The Shadow and My Gal Sunday and The Life of Stella Dallas or The Romance of Stella Dallas. Yeah. All those wonderful soap operas I grew up on.
When you started as a radio journalist, as you were talking earlier, who were the radio journalists that you admired or influenced you, or were there any?
Oh, my gosh. Susan Stamberg was right there.
Oh, yes.
I mean, she was the first voice and has become a dear friend. She was part of my last book on my own. I interviewed her for that. And then, of course, came Cokie Roberts and Linda Wertheimer and all those wonderful people who made NPR what it is. And now with COVID, I mean, I've been out of the building since January. My beautiful office remains totally vacant. Most of the building, in fact, is vacant. I think there are about 3 or 4 people in there making things continue to run. I hope to God we'll get beyond this.
So the book is called When My Time Comes, Conversations About Whether Those Who Are Dying Should Have the Right to Determine When Life Should End. And the author, the brilliant Diane Rehm, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.